Heterodorks. Heterodox dorks.
Hey, TERFs and trannies. This is Nina Paley, your co-host of Heterodorks.
And this is Corinna Cohn. And today we have a guest and author, Kara Dansky, with us. Kara, congratulations on your book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess we should start by you tell us about the book.
Sure. So it was earlier this year when a publisher contacted me, having seen me on Tucker Carlson. I know you both know that I have been on Tucker Carlson a few times, and that's where he saw me. And he basically pitched the idea of a book by saying, look, he made it clear that he considers himself a mainstream conservative. And he kind of pitched the idea of a book directed at American liberals who either are confused about what's going on in the gender land, or alternatively are not confused. There are so many American liberals who reach out to me frequently who can see what's going on and who are very frustrated with Democratic Party leadership, but may not have the vocabulary to talk about it. And so we talked for a few months and the plans came together. And yeah, the whole thing happened very quickly with respect to book publication. My understanding is that it can frequently take at least a year, if not more. This one happened much faster because there's a need for it. You know, there's a real hunger, I think, in the U.S. among American liberals for understanding this issue. And so the book is in part intended to fill that gap.
What is the title of the book?
Oh, sorry. The title of the book is The Abolition of Sex, How the, quote, Transgender Agenda, It Harms Women and Girls.
And where can people order this?
For the moment, it's only available on Amazon. Mm. And I should say I was not involved in the decision to put it on Amazon. That's a publisher's decision. For the people who don't want to use Amazon, I completely respect that choice. So for now, it's on Amazon. And the reason that the decision was made to do that, my understanding, having very little understanding of the publishing world in general, but that was the fastest way to do it. And because the publisher and I both thought that there's an urgency about this, there's a hunger for it, and it just needed to go as quickly as possible. So it's print on demand on Amazon. There were other practical considerations that have everything to do with the weird world in which we find ourselves, which is that in order to print hard copies in advance and ship them to the UK, the publisher was concerned that they'd get stuck on a cargo ship. Mm-hmm. So, you know, weird stuff like that, that has nothing to do with any of our issues.
Yeah, it's just the age of COVID.
Yeah.
I'm reminded that I think earlier this year or late last year, Amazon made the choice to ban Ryan Anderson's book that was titled When Harry Became Sally. And Amazon put out some statement saying that they were not going to allow anything. Well, I think they would probably phrase it differently, but they put out a statement saying that they would not put anything critical of transgender ideology for sale through their storefront. Are you worried at all that Amazon
Sure.
might ban your book?
Sure.
Are you are you hoping that maybe that happens?
No, of course not. But you know, I say it in the book. There's an area where I talk about the media and social media in general. And as you know, I know you both know, and probably many of your listeners know, we've got this situation where Meghan Murphy was banned, and Posey Parker, Graham Linehan. You know, we all know the story. So I talk about it in the book, and then there's a sentence toward the end of that little section that says Amazon has said that it will not publish work that I forget, like you, Corinna, I forget the phrasing that Amazon used, but I mentioned that very thing in the book itself, and it's up on Amazon now.
How long has it been available?
Since yesterday morning.
Oh my gosh. Well, I wanted to ask how reception has been, but I guess it's pretty early.
It's pretty early. I can't see anything beyond what anyone else can see on Amazon. So I can't see how book sales have been for the past 24 or 36 hours or whatever it's been. But it's been very well received on social media. I'm very grateful that Abigail Schreier retweeted it to her 120 or so thousand followers. So so far, it appears to be well received, at least, you know, among the group of people who are Abigail Schreier's Twitter followers, right? So I don't know how well received it will be among a broader audience.
What's your current, like, title? Like, if we say Kara Danski is, I mean, you're no longer with Wolf, what's your title with women? You're with the Women's Human Rights Campaign, right?
Yeah. So just to be clear, I am still a member of Wolf, but mm-hmm. I'm not on the leadership.
Yeah.
So I am the current president of the U.S. chapter of the Women's Human Rights Campaign.
Excellent. And what is the Women's Human Rights Campaign doing?
Thanks for asking. So the Women's Human Rights Campaign is a global group of largely volunteer women that is dedicated to advancing something called the Declaration on Women's Sex-Based Rights in law and policy all over the world. And it is signed by over 20,000 people and several hundred organizations. I forget exactly how many. But the purpose of it really is to empower women and girls to talk to lawmakers, policymakers, academics, and explain the dangers of enshrining, or in the US case, literally redefining sex to include gender identity. So we do a lot of advocacy. We have the US chapter has, well, let me say this, the global chapter is really working very closely on international law. So there've been a lot of submissions to the UN, various bodies like the EU and European Tribunal of Human Rights. I'm going to botch that, but those kinds of international law bodies is what the global organization has focused on. In the US, we've submitted advocacy to the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee regarding the so-called Equality Act. We have met with staff of Senator Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, regarding the same thing. We've done a lot of advocacy at the state level to encourage lawmakers to protect women's sports. So that's a lot of what we do.
And are you getting better results with conservative politicians as opposed to Democrats? It seems like the Biden administration is pretty married to gender ideology. That's how it seems to me, but I'm just a mere spectator.
Yeah, it's really interesting. If you look just at the federal government, I think that you are 100% correct about that. The Biden administration and Democratic leadership in both houses of Congress have made their positions quite clear and are quite married to the enshrinement of gender identity in the law, for now, at least publicly. And that is also true at the state level for the most part. But interestingly, we have had some, I think, really productive conversations with staff. And part of the reason I think that those conversations have been productive is that I don't hesitate to say at the beginning of a meeting with Senate staffers, because it is absolutely true that WHRC is a nonpartisan organization, and it has to be because it's global. There would be no way to make it partisan because there are different political parties in every country. But in the US, we're also nonpartisan, and signatories to the declaration include Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and Greens. But among leadership, most of us are registered Democrats, or at least have been for most of our lives. And so I don't hesitate to tell a Democratic staffer, WHRC USA is a nonpartisan organization. Speaking for myself, I am a lifelong Democrat, and that has been, that's been helpful to get Democratic staff to at least listen, because it's hard for them to view me as the enemy if I'm not a Republican, which I never have been.
I noticed that over the last 10 years, I guess this gender ideology stuff really started to break out about 10, 11 years ago, that people on the left, especially media on the left, treats the whole issue, the whole critical point of view, I should say, as though it's extremely toxic. And that as things have proceeded over time, as Nina said, the Biden administration is a really good example of politicians really going further and further in the extremes of saying things like trans women are women and gender identity instead of sex. I'm going to assume that we all agree that the Democratic Party and the left are really committing themselves to this point of view. How do we drag people out of that mindset?
Well, I totally agree with how the media frames this. it is very easy and frankly very lazy for mainstream media. And by the way, I hate the phrase mainstream media because I don't, you know, it's so overused in our culture, but I'm going to use it for shorthand because we sort of know what I mean. It's very easy and lazy for them to frame this as a partisan issue. And it is my view that they know that there is a feminist, gay rights, lesbian rights critique of gender identity and that they deliberately suppress it.
What do you think is behind this? I mean, one view could be that there's like a conspiracy or some sort of coordinated moneyed interest of doing it. The view I ascribe to is that it's more of an emergent behavior, an emergent social movement. But what do you think is behind this fairly locked arm tactic of shutting down any critical perspectives?
So I read a lot on Jennifer Billick's 11th Hour blog, and I think she writes very persuasively about the money behind this. And it's been extremely successful in when I say it, I mean the movement to enshrine so-called gender identity in the law has been very successful because it has been framed as a civil rights movement to legally protect the rights of a quote-unquote marginalized community. But that, in fact, is not what's going on. In fact, what's going on is a very top-down, money-driven movement, you know, to obliterate sex, or as the title of my book would argue, to abolish sex.
Do you believe there's some central coordination?
I make the argument in the book, drawing on Jen Billick's work, that there is an industry that Jen has called the gender identity industry. And I make it very clear that I'm not claiming that there is some, that it's not the case that it would legally constitute a conspiracy. Right? A legal conspiracy is an explicit agreement among entities to do something. And, mm-hmm. and I don't think anyone thinks that's what's happening. Maybe Jen Billick thinks that. I don't know. But I certainly can't prove that there is. But nonetheless, there is a loosely affiliated conglomeration of law firms and organizations and corporate interests that do seem to be pretty aligned in their devotion to abolishing sex and replacing it with quote unquote gender identity. And we also know from the Denton's law firm document, are you both familiar with that?
I've heard of it, but could you give a quick background for anybody listening who is unfamiliar?
Yeah, my understanding is that it was the Denton's law firm in coordination with Thomas Reuters that they put out this document that makes it very clear that the tactics being used to enshrine gender identity in law are done by stealth, deliberately. They're done below the radar, so the public doesn't know what's happening. And that's the objective. Like, that's literally the deliberate tactic to enshrine gender identity in the law.
What do you think they're getting out of it? Like, is this just some powerful fetishists who are just like completely consumed by their fetish, or is it pharmaceutical industries being able to profit? I mean, certainly that seems, the pharmaceutical profit motive does seem to be pretty obvious candidate for.
It's really interesting, right? Because if it's the pharmaceutical industry, arguably, if it's the pharmaceutical industry that's driving this, then the movement would not be pushing self-ID, right? Because self-ID is the claim that anyone can identify with either sex or none at all, just by saying so.
Right.
And that doesn't benefit the pharmaceutical industry at all. But if the movement as a whole pushes the concept of self-ID, which it is, and if the public ultimately rejects that, which I think it ultimately will, once they figure out what's going on, then the pharmaceutical industry does benefit, because then you get to say, all right, if you're not going to allow self-identification, then we have to allow everybody, you know, we have to have government-funded genital surgeries, government-funded endocrine administration of hormones. That's certainly what I would argue if I were them.
Well, we're more or less there now. The number of commercial or businesses that have insurance coverage for what is called the gender medicine industry, the number of insurance policies that cover that is huge at this point.
It is. And of course, we also know that pediatric, quote, gender clinics are popping up all over the place. There were very few just a few years ago. Now there's something like over 300 in the US and Canada or something like that. I don't know the exact data, but it's around there. And certainly if you put young people on a lifetime regimen of hormones, that clearly benefits the pharmaceutical industry.
I like to think of it more, Kara, in terms of I'm buying somebody their dream yacht. So I'm helping people by being a lifelong medical patient.
Right.
Yes, boosting the economy. Well done, Corinna. It's very patriotic. Trans is patriotic. I mean, you must sit around just going like, why? How? I mean, people do have like these expansive theories ultimately, you know, and some of them are a little off the wall, right? Like some people speculate that it's a population control conspiracy, which makes no sense to me, because if you want to actually control population, this is an incredibly ineffective way to do it. But I mean, I personally see misogyny in it. I think, who was it that said, that called the trans rights movement a men's sexual rights movement? Was that Sheila Jeffries?
I mean, Sheila definitely says that, but I think, I don't know who sort of started the idea, but it certainly seems clear to me that that's the case.
So you would call it a men's sexual rights movement?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I sort of try to make the case in the book that it is a combination of men's sexual rights run amok and also corporate greed. Those things aren't separate. They never have been.
And the corporate, how does the corporate greed work?
Well, that's sort of what we were talking about, I think, with the pharmaceutical industry. It's not just the pharmaceutical industry. John Stryker stands as heir to a massively wealthy surgical supply company. So it's the surgeries as well as the hormones.
Who is John Stryker?
So John Stryker founded the Arcus Foundation.
Okay.
Which has billions of dollars, and it funds, quote, LGBTQ causes, which really means TQ. And yeah, so that's why it exists. And it recently gave the ACLU $15 million to do this stuff, which is an extraordinary donation to a nonprofit, $15 million in March of this year that I know of.
And you used to be with the ACLU, right? Let's talk about the ACLU. How did it get completely captured?
Yeah, I was at the ACLU from 2012 to 2014, and I was working on the so-called progressive criminal justice reform movement. I was the primary author of the ACLU's report on police militarization. I was very active in the campaign to end mass incarceration. And this stuff wasn't really around then. I mean, I'm sure it was around, but it wasn't really, you know, what it is now, certainly. And also, so I left the ACLU in December 2014. I believe that Chase Strangio joined the ACLU earlier in 2014. So Chase and I overlapped at the ACLU for some period of time. I don't know exactly how long, although I don't believe we ever met in person. And it was right around that time that things kind of started going off the rails.
I mean, how did it topple so easily? It's completely lost the plot, the ACLU. But the ACLU is who, like 10 years ago, I would have gone to when I got canceled, when I got blacklisted, basically. But right now it's like they're doing the blacklisting.
Right. I mean, it's interesting, right? There was a case that came out of Ohio, a public university in Ohio, where there's a professor who had a pedagogical practice of referring to his students as either Ms. or Mr. And, you know, one can think whatever one likes about that. What, you know, we might find that old fashioned or whatever. But anyway, that was his pedagogical style. And he had a student who was male, who demanded to be referred to as she and her and using the title Ms. And he didn't want to do that. and the student made a really big deal out of it, called the professor all sorts of really nasty names that I won't repeat, and made a big deal out of it. And this professor ended up getting disciplined by the public university, and he sued, and he lost at the federal district court level, and he appealed, and he eventually won in the Sixth Circuit, which ruled that public school professors cannot be disciplined in any way for refusing to use opposite sex pronouns and titles in their classroom. Now, it's kind of interesting to me that most people have no idea that that's true, right? Probably you two have never heard of that case, and that's not a criticism. It's just my guess. Yeah, because the media won't report it. And so those are sort of two of the interesting takeaways from that is, one, the media won't report it. And two, the ACLU had nothing to say about this professor's free speech rights. Nothing. This was a major case for free speech. And the ACLU not only didn't support him legally, but had nothing to say about it.
As far as you know, did the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education back that professor?
I don't know. I mean, I know that he was represented by Alliance Defending Freedom lawyers.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know if that particular group filed a brief in support or anything like that.
Well, that sort of brings up a question that I was interested in, or a topic I was interested in. Because there are so few people who are on the left and are willing to be open allies to things like Wolf or the, I'm sorry, I'm going to misremember this, Women Human Rights?
Yep.
I'm missing the last letter.
Campaign.
Campaign, thank you.
No worries.
Since there's so few people on the left who are willing to be outspoken on this, there seems to be more comfort on the right. And I worry a little bit that there might be some form of ideological capture of these movements that have started as feminist movements, but are receiving more support from people on the right.
So when you say support, do you mean financial support?
Not just financial support, but even moral support, media coverage as well.
Yeah, I mean, so in my experience, that just hasn't happened, right? I mean, I know Wolf got a lot of criticism when I was on the board in 2016, and we received money from ADF. That's not a secret or anything. We got a lot of criticism for that. And part of the criticism, and I understand it, part of the criticism was that Wolf was going to cave on any of its principles, and it didn't. I mean, it just didn't at all. Wolf didn't change any of its stances on anything. And also, to the best of my knowledge, at least when I was on the board, ADF never asked it to.
I guess another concern, though, is that that's a form of triangulation of ADF wasn't doing that out of the generosity of their heart. They were doing it because it was in support of part of their own agenda, right?
Well, they were doing it because they want to win.
Right.
Yeah, sure. Why not? I mean, to that point, I mean, the ACLU frequently brags about affiliating with conservative organizations when it suits them. The ACLU openly, you can just Google ACLU unlikely allies, and you'll get numerous instances where the ACLU brags about affiliations with ADF, with I don't even remember which other ones, but I know that they were on the same side of a First Amendment case with ADF, and they were quite happy to brag about that.
Can you tell me what ADF stands for?
Oh, Alliance Defending Freedom, sorry.
Thanks.
They are a Christian organization, if my recollection is right.
Yeah. They are. Yeah. They're a Christian conservative organization for sure.
So I guess if I were in the position of Wolf or the Women's Human Rights Campaign, one of the things I'd really want to try to accomplish is getting somebody who is more visible on the left and does have a good reputation among the left to also provide more open support. And I guess that's just obvious that that's something that those organizations would try to work towards.
Yeah, but as soon as someone on the left offers that support, they're accused of being on the right.
Yeah, and also, you know, if you can get me on Rachel Maddow, I'd go on there in a heartbeat, you know? If you can get Gloria Steinem to come back and, like, actually be a radical feminist, that'd be great. they're just not going to do it.
And I can say, as somebody who's a somewhat dissident voice in the trans community, over the last 7 or 8 years or so, I've tried reaching out to quite a few people in media. And the only person who ever took something I sent seriously was Michelle Goldberg. And mm-hmm. now she won't return any of my emails because I think she got really savaged for printing something that featured people who are gender critical.
Can you explain what media outlet is Michelle Goldberg with?
She's with the New York Times currently, but she was with Slate and had printed a piece called The Trans Women Who Say Trans Women Aren't Women or something to that effect. And that was 2015. Just a side note, that article was the number one article on their website for over a week. And there was not a single site on the left, much less gay or lesbian sites, that took that up or argued it or anything. It was just complete radio silence. But that topic was the number one topic on the website the week that it was published.
In 2015.
In 2015, yeah. We'll link to it in the show notes.
She also did a piece in, I want to say it was The New Yorker, called What is a Woman? When she explored this issue, I thought quite thoughtfully. And she quoted some radical feminists from back in the day as really holding the line on what the word woman means. But she's caved since. She published something just within the past week, or maybe 2 weeks, that was just utterly uncritical in the Times.
I guess she knows where her bread is buttered.
Yeah.
So this is a ongoing source of strife among American feminists, is whether you're on the left, whether you're left or not. There's a sort of purity politics among feminists, and some feminists are just, they don't want you to be on Tucker Carlson. Being on Tucker Carlson is enough to get you excommunicated from some circles. That's my impression anyway.
Yeah. And the whole thing is pretty funny because from the perspective of UK feminists, all Americans are completely conservative. Like, you know what I mean? Like from a British perspective, the American Democrats are totally conservative. So they just think it's bizarre. But anyway, that's absolutely the case. Although, Nina, I will tell you, I get a lot less flack for going on Tucker Carlson in 2021 than I got in 2017.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, every time I go on, 3 million or 4 million people hear radical feminism. That can't be a bad thing. But also, it's really interesting because I think there's a role to play in educating Republicans on what radical feminism is and isn't, right? Because they love to hate us. Mainstream Republicans absolutely love to hate radical feminists and blame us for all the ills of the world. And so I think there's value in a radical feminist like myself or Julia Beck going on Tucker Carlson and kind of normalizing radical feminists for mainstream conservatives who probably think that we're like all sitting around cauldrons, you know, with pointing hats and cackling all the time. Not that we don't do some of that, but
yeah, you got to have some fun.
Well, yeah, that's how we have fun. The cauldron party. That's how I met Kara, around a cauldron. Well, I do notice when I hear conservatives complaining about feminists, what they're describing is not radical feminists. They seem to be describing sort of liberal feminists of the, you know, third wave feminists, but they just use this blanket term feminist.
Yeah, because they don't know. I mean, they just don't know. And also it's lazy, you know, it's lazy. It's easy to blame women for all of society's problems. To a certain extent, that's just what's going on there.
Yes.
If something's wrong, it's her fault.
Yes, but they do often cite like ridiculous so-called feminist positions that are not radical feminist positions.
They do. They absolutely do.
Like, you know, the pro-sex work stuff and the lesbian dating apps that are full of men. I guess they're not really blaming feminists for that. That was funny. Did you see that? I forget who that super right-wing white supremacist guy was going through profiles of men on the Her dating app, which is supposed to be for lesbians, and pointed out that there were all these men. And one of the men was Graham Linehan from his Having a Lark. Did you?
Yep.
Yeah, that was Alex Jones.
Alex Jones, okay.
And from what I understand, their date did not go very well. Alex leaned over for a kiss and Graham would not indulge him.
Wow.
Yeah, and Alex paid for dinner, so you'd think that Graham owed him one, but no.
Yeah.
It seems like the ice is starting to melt in the UK. Stonewall, the criticism that has been stacking up over the years, is finally leaning against them and causing them to crumble a bit, and that's good. And the UK feminists are making a lot of progress that I would really like to see mirrored over in the United States, but it doesn't seem like there's quite as much energy in the system over here. Do you agree, or if you do, what do you think needs to happen to get more energy built up?
Yes and no. Well, I mean, first of all, I totally agree that the UK feminists are just killing it. They're just doing fantastic. So that's great. And they're a total inspiration. And I'm going to get over there just as soon as I can, or I plan to anyway. So all that progress is really great. Part of it is I honestly think that the UK media has been, as bad as a lot of it has been, it has been much more honest than the US media about covering this stuff. So they have more visibility than we have. And then there's the other, you know, the practical problem that, you know, if you live in Bristol and there's an event at Speaker's Corner in London, you hop on a train and you're an hour away. And we don't have that here. You know, we have to hop on a plane to go most places. And it's just hard. You know, we're just a massive, massive country. And so coordinating that type of on the ground activism is just a more difficult and more expensive endeavor. And, you know, none of us have any money particularly. So it's just harder as a practical matter. But I do think their media's somewhat fair coverage of the issue has played a huge role, and our media just doesn't do it.
I was just gonna say that is true. Like the New York Times is a disaster. Yeah, so much American media is a disaster, which goes back to who is benefiting from this and why are they so easily captured?
There's hopefully a chink in the armor somewhere. I'm thinking Newsweek has been pretty even about offering editorial space to people who are critical of some of the trans ideology.
Yeah, they have. And yeah, I'm jaded because like I've pitched them things and been rejected. So maybe I'm just like unhelpfully annoyed at them. And maybe I just need to not give up with them. Because you're right, they have pitched some, or they have published some, you know, somewhat fair coverage of this stuff.
But they published Scott Nugent's article, right?
Could be. Yeah, that sounds familiar. I don't know what it's going to take to break through the media. I do know. So if I say Loudoun County, do you both know sort of the relevance to this conversation?
Yes.
Yes. It's CRT, right? And only CRT. Nothing else happened in Loudoun. It's only critical race theory.
So here's what is so infuriating to me personally about that is that, you know, I live in DC, which is about an hour from Loudoun County. And I went to Loudoun County in August. And in August, I went to a rally and there were just a broad range of issues covered. A lot of people there were talking about the gender stuff. A lot of people were talking about CRT. A lot of people were really mad about mask mandates and vaccine mandates. So it's kind of all over the place in August. Later, and then the board passed the, you know, the policy that it did. And do I need to say what that is for your listeners?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So in mid-August, I think it was the 12th, the Loudoun County School Board passed a policy over the objection of many parents, and the policy allows any student to use any facility of their choice in accordance with their quote unquote gender identity. And it also contains a lot of mandates with regard to the use of pronouns that a lot of teachers objected to. The board passed it anyway. So that was August. And then it came out that in May, a teenage girl had been assaulted in a bathroom by a boy who claimed to be gender fluid. That was how he called himself. And he assaulted her. I think, I don't want to misstate this, but he has been convicted in juvenile court. So I may get the exact charges wrong, but he has been convicted. So we know that it happened. I believe that he orally and anally sodomized her. That is my understanding, in the girl's bathroom. And the board knew that. And the board passed this policy knowing that. So fast forward to October, just a few weeks ago, there was another rally outside the Loudoun County School District building, and a group of parents wanted to go and protest the policy. And typically, it will not surprise you to hear that it's typically conservatives who want to protest the policy. In this instance, in October, the parents just came together as parents, and they made a very deliberate decision not to be partisan about it. They didn't want to have partisan issues at all. They wanted to come together as parents to talk about the importance of protecting their children's safety. And I went and I was there and I was pretty moved by it, because there were like a handful of people talking about CRT, but the overwhelming majority of people there were talking about the gender policy. And one woman told a story about her daughter who had been sexually assaulted in the school. That wasn't the girl who got sexually assaulted in May. It was a different instance. And it didn't have anything to do with bathrooms. She was just talking about the importance of schools protecting children's safety. And it was heartbreaking. You know, she cried when she was telling the story about her daughter getting sexually assaulted. And so the parents were all there, or I should say overwhelmingly there, talking about the gender policy. And I went with a bunch of radical feminist lefty women. And I stood at the rally with a sign over my head that said, this Democrat supports female only spaces, with a bunch of arrows pointing at my head. And the woman next to me had a sign that said, this Democrat says, get boys out of girls' spaces. And the other women had signs that were kind of similar to that. The media, for the most part, ignored us, with the exception of the Federalist. The Federalist saw us. And of course, the Federalist is a conservative publication. And they were fascinated. Mm-hmm. They were just totally fascinated to see that. And there's an image of it that showed up in the Federalist. And then the Daily Mail picked it up in the UK. So that's good. But I guess my point is that part of what makes me so mad, and Karina, this is what you were alluding to, I was there. I know that the overwhelming majority of parents who were complaining about the gender policy. They also have concerns about CRT, which is true, but they weren't talking about it that night. And then the Republican won for governor. And this is what you're referring to, right? Like, all the media frames it as a bunch of racist Republicans who were mad about CRT in schools. I don't think that's the case. I'm sure that is the case for some part of the electorate. I'm sure that that's true. But I don't know. I can't prove it. But I bet that a whole lot of Democrats voted for Youngkin for governor because of the gender stuff.
Let me ask your opinion. These parents, if the school policy had been that gender diverse students were allocated their own individual single-use bathrooms and changing spaces, and that was the policy, do you think that there would have been any attention at all on the issue?
No.
The parents wouldn't have cared at all?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
They want their kids to be safe. They want their girls to be in a bathroom with other girls.
So it's really, the issue is the abolition of the idea of sex in favor of the replacement of gender identity. That's really the issue.
I don't know that the parents would frame it that way, because they're much less educated about this issue than the three of us are. But I'm listening to these parents, they just want their kids to be safe, and part of what that means is they don't want boys in the girls' bathroom or the girls' locker room. It really, you know, these are, they may be Republican conservative ideologues on a whole bunch of issues that I would disagree with them on. But on this stuff, they're not, you know, they're not reading a bunch of Andrea Dworkin. They're not, you know what I mean? Like, they just want their girls to be safe.
It seems so easy to beat Democrats right now.
To beat? Yeah.
To beat Democrats. Yes. It's like, if you just stand up on this particular issue, you can beat a Democrat. Nobody wants this, but the majority of people don't want this. I mean, a very select group of men want it. Well, maybe not a select group. I don't know. I don't really understand how this has swayed so many people. It's like they just don't think it through. Maybe the thing is with parents have to like actually think about the actual repercussions for their daughters. But you would also think that like young women would be connecting the dots and seeing their own rights eliminated.
But Nina, these are all good people.
Yeah, I'm not good enough. That's my problem. I want to be more good, and I have to really like demonstrate that by showing that I have a luxury belief that does not protect me or anyone else.
So here's something I've been thinking a lot about this. I think that Americans, and maybe lots of people all over the world, but I don't know. I'm just talking about Americans here. I think that the vast majority of Americans across the political aisle, Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, and Greens, probably think that trans is some form of super gay, or like there's some special kind of gay. And so for Democrats, that means that like it has to have extra special attention. And for Republicans, that means, well, it's just this weird little community over here and I don't have to worry about it because they're not going to come to my church and they're not going to come to my Freemasons meeting or whatever Republicans do. I don't know. But you know what I mean? So like
cauldrons, they have cauldrons also.
But like, I think across the political spectrum, and I can't take credit for that phrase, that I'm pretty sure that's a Lier Keith phrase. Everyone thinks it's a super special form of gay. And so for Democrats, that means that it requires extra super special protection. And for Republicans, it just means it's a weird fringe thing that they don't have to worry about. But the problem is that that's all wrong, right? Like identity, having a quote unquote gender identity has nothing to do with attraction to other.
Well, depends, right?
What? Does it?
Oh, you mean if you're like a pseudo, what do you call it? An autogynephile, what do they call it? Pseudo homosexual? I forget the phrasing of it. Like somebody who's so turned on, a heterosexual man can be so turned on by the idea of himself as a woman that he will engage in sex with men in order to validate his so-called womanhood.
Right, but that's not authentic same-sex attraction.
That is true. But it's still a same-sex behavior. Yeah, it's weird. It's just weird that this just runs roughshod over the gay rights movement that I stood for the last many decades. It's really weird. And it's weird for me to see some of the gay men that I knew as boys that influenced me to really care about gay rights. They've completely thrown women under the bus.
Sure.
That's been weird.
Yeah.
Like disorienting. Like, oh, I've been supporting this for 40 years, partly because I knew you when I was a kid. And you've just thrown me and all the other women and all the homosexuals, all your fellow homosexuals under the bus.
Right. And, you know, because I get like, I turn into a like weird law nerd, you know, I think about things like the 2015 Obergefell decision, which is very explicitly about protecting marriage for same-sex attracted couples. And the Supreme Court was not confused about this in 2015. They got it right. You know, they could see that granting marriage rights to opposite sex attracted couples while refusing to grant marriage rights to same-sex attracted couples was really unfair to same-sex attracted people. They were not confused. It was perfectly obvious. And they voted, in my view, the right way. And here we are 6 years later. And, you know, you have no reason to know this, but I'll just tell you and hope that you'll believe me. A couple years ago, I want to say it was 2019, the Third Circuit, which is located in Philadelphia, had oral arguments in a case involving a bathroom gender identity policy, and a judge on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals told a lawyer that he's not allowed to use the phrase opposite sex because the judge found the phrase opposite sex confusing. So I really need someone to explain to me how the Supreme Court in 2015 knew exactly what the phrase opposite sex meant, used it repeatedly in the Obergefell decision, and somehow a couple years later, a Court of Appeals judge, which is one step below the Supreme Court, is somehow confused by the phrase opposite sex. That's in the...
John Stryker got at him.
I mean, maybe, but what really mystifies me is that, you know, you can sort of explain it with elected officials because they have to raise a lot of money to run campaigns. Federal judges have lifetime appointments. They don't have to run for anything ever. They have to get appointed. And once they're appointed, they have to not get
impeached.
Thank you. You have to get appointed to the court, and then you just have to survive without getting impeached until you die. So I don't know if John Stryker got to him, but anyway, sorry, that's a tangent.
Well, in the UK, it's coming out that there are these lobbying groups that do like educational programs for the judges there. Yes. So I assume that's happening here too. I assume that there's like a influence loophole that is permitting education of judges in the UK. It's also police. I don't know. Maybe police in the US are also getting this, you know, education.
I'm sure.
That's provided by lobbying groups.
Yes.
I mean, which has to stop if that's the case.
I did. I'm a member of the DC bar, and I got an email one day several months ago that said, hey, we're having a CLE, continuing legal education. We're having a CLE on sex and gender in the law. And I was like, all right, I guess I better go to that. not because I felt like I needed an education on the topic, but I really wanted to hear what was being taught. And it was nonsense. It was just complete and utter nonsense.
And who was supplying it? Who was offering this education?
I mean, the institution that offered it was the DC Bar Association. The individual teacher was, I don't know, some lawyer who put herself out as an expert on this topic.
Hmm.
Did you get to learn about the gender unicorn?
We did not learn about the gender unicorn. No, it was just nonsensical. It was just nonsensical. And I tried to ask a couple of pointed questions, not because I necessarily cared about the answer, but because I wanted the lawyer's answers to be as nonsensical as possible so that fellow participants could see just how nonsensical she was being. I don't know if I succeeded in that, but that was my goal.
I don't know if you're one of our six listeners, Kara, but if you are, you might have heard one of our earlier episodes. I think it was episode 6. We'll link it. Where I declare that the gender critical movement is over. And I declared that because that week was the one where Marjorie Taylor Greene had put up a sign outside of her office. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was a refutation of her neighbor's transgender flag. And it looked like at the time, Marjorie Taylor Greene was set to become the face of the anti-transgender activist movement in the United States. And what I was thinking at back in March, I think this was when I said this, is that the gender critical movement has now been captured by the most fringe elements on the right. And in fact, over this conversation, I don't think we've mentioned the term gender critical very much. And I know some people are trying to change that or move away from the term or disavow it. Do you think there is a gender critical movement now? Or what do you think the future of it is going to be?
I mean, one thing is, it just seems to me that the phrase gender critical has a lot more, it is much more popular in the UK than it is here. It just seems to me, especially with the Maya Forstater decision, right, where the court found that quote unquote gender critical beliefs are worthy of protection in a just society or whatever it was. But the phrase gender critical is showing up in court documents in the UK. And a lot of UK feminists refer to themselves as gender critical. I feel like it has a lot less resonance in the US, even though those of us here know what it means generally. I have not particularly ever cared whether I get, I've not really cared whether I'm considered gender critical or not gender critical. I think I care a little bit more now because I'm liking the phrase a lot less because I'm just much more interested in gender abolition. Anyway, these are just meanderings of me, you know, but your question is interesting. And I guess I think a couple things. I think the Marjorie Taylor Greens of our society do us no favors, right? Like, she's not helping for sure. I think that's kind of the point that you're not saying that exactly, but I think that's kind of the point you're making. And I don't want, appreciate, or need Marjorie Taylor Greene's help here. Not interested. But of course, I don't want her to be there anyway. I pay as much attention as I feel like I have to pay in order to be educated about what's going on in the United States Congress. But, you know, I hope she goes away as quickly as possible. I don't want her making decisions about anything. But no, I mean, I think that things have changed a lot in 2021. I think that things have changed a lot in 2021. And I think as things continue to change, that we're eventually going to have to force the media to have an honest reckoning with the fact that there are leftist, feminist, gay rights critiques of this stuff. We're not a bunch of Marjorie Taylor Greens. We're just not. They can't keep lying about that. I mean, they can, and they will for a while. But, you know, we're here, and we're getting louder, and we're making more noise.
They can lie for a long time. It's pretty amazing to me.
They can, but, you know, when you do the activism, you know, so I mentioned that we've sent stuff to Majority Leader Schumer, and that's true. But when I say that, I don't mean we sent something into the void. What I mean is there's a woman who lives in New York who is a constituent of Senator Schumer, right? So he is both a senator from New York and also the majority leader of the United States Senate. So a woman in New York, radical feminist, leftist Democrat, got a meeting with his staff, which is her right to do as a constituent. And so we had the email address of a key staffer in his office and met and explained our concerns, explained that we're all Democrats, even though WHRC is nonpartisan. And then it came time to submit a letter to Majority Leader Schumer. And we did that. And WHRC globally was able to get thousands of women's signatures from all over the world on this letter to Majority Leader Schumer saying, do not pass the Equality Act. And here are the reasons why. And we didn't just send it into the void or to some random email address or some random, you know, internet contact form. We sent it directly to a key staffer in his office who confirmed that she received it and promised us that she would give it to Majority Leader Schumer. So I say all of that to say that when you really get in and do the activism and the advocacy, we're having more of an impact than you might think. Like, we really are. I don't know exactly why the Equality Act hasn't gotten anywhere. It may just be because of the filibuster stuff, but I don't know. Majority Leader Schumer laid eyes on a 2-page letter from a global feminist organization explaining our feminist critique of gender identity signed by thousands of women all over the world. And we know he got it. You know, we sent it directly there and she confirmed receipt. I know that my written testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee got before every member of the committee because I got responses from them confirming receipt of my written testimony. So I don't know, you know, it's not like we're just screaming into the void and no one's listening to us, although it feels like that most of the time. We're making inroads and we're making headway. I don't even know why I'm going on and on about this right now. Nina, what did you ask me to?
I don't even remember, but I do think that that's hopeful because that, you know, it wasn't always clear in the UK that they were going to win. It wasn't that long ago that the Maya Forstetter case wasn't decided yet. And then, you know, the first time it went to court, there was a bad decision made and they had to appeal and stuff like that. So it's just a long slog and a long fight. And I guess we're fighting here and yep. Maybe maybe it'll pay off here. It'll probably take a lot longer, but maybe it will.
Yeah. I realized also we kind of got there because of Karina's question about gender critical. I've gotten to the place where I don't really like that phrase very much. I'm much more interested in gender abolition, but I don't, this is, I think, the point I was trying to make, and I made it very inartfully. We don't need Marjorie Taylor Greene. We don't want her. We don't need her. We're going to win because we're on the right side.
Well, something that I've tried to help my fellow trannies understand is that the whole idea of gender identity is not based on anything except for it's akin to a religious belief. And if you're putting all of your hopes into that being a category, there's nothing underneath it. There's no foundation for it. And so the idea of sex in the long run is always going to win out over gender identity because it's based in reality.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. And I will also just say, look, like you get to call yourself whatever you want. You get to call your show whatever you want to call it. I will not use that word. I just won't do it.
You won't use what word?
You know the word I won't use.
Oh, was that the T word that Karina used?
Yeah.
Yeah, Karina's flaunting it.
Yeah.
Karina gets to do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I said. Like, but I just wanted to make my position clear. I'm not going to use it.
All right, as I should say, he gets to do that.
Yeah. And for that reason, I don't really know what it means.
If, you know, somebody takes umbrage to it, that means that they're wearing the shoe and it's probably a size 12 high heel.
There was something related to that. I was going to say, oh, my stupid brain.
I said shoes, Nina, and there it goes. You're just on that track.
Yeah, all I care about is shoes. It's genetic. It's my biology.
Because you're Because
I'm a woman. That's really how you tell.
Right. I mean, I did celebrate the publication of my book yesterday by going out and buying some combat boots. So that was fun.
Very good.
Yeah, still shoes, though. Even if they're combat boots, they're shoes.
So speaking of the T word, let me ask maybe the most challenging question so far. Over in the UK, there is some debate among the opposition to gender identity, whether people such as myself and Randy Yardley, who's a friend of mine, and Debbie Hayton, who I have not met but has written prolifically in the UK press, whether people of our ilk are able to productively contribute to the opposition of the encroachment of gender identity. What's your take?
Well, I guess I need to ask, what do you mean by people of our ilk?
I mean people who have, let's say, taken advantage of the opportunity to invoke the legal fiction that we are a sex opposite to that which we were born.
So we know that in the U.S. we don't have the GRA.
Right.
So that doesn't exist formally in the same way here that it does in the U.K. But you're asking me a different question. You're asking me, I mean, I guess, honestly, you're asking me a different form of the question, can men help?
I am. Specifically men who make a claim to having a trans identification of some sort.
I mean, to me, it's still the question of can men help?
Okay.
It's not a different question. And I think at the end of the day, sure, men can be very helpful in this movement. But more specifically to, I think what, I'm being a little bit disingenuous, I appreciate that. But, and I do understand what you're asking, but I don't think it helps the movement. If the movement is to liberate women, which is what I'm interested in, it does not help to have men who claim some form of womanhood on our side.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Now, actually, I was on a UK podcast earlier today trying to describe Karina to a bunch of UK TERFs. And I was like, well, I can't say that he's trans-identified because he's disenchanted. He's because you're not actually trans identified. You're, well, the radical feminist language I would use is a feminized eunuch, which is like really jarring for anybody who is polite. We don't have to worry about that.
Not around here.
Yeah, not around here. But it's like, you're not actually trans identified. You're, yeah.
But I used to be.
Yes, you used to be trans identified. You're identified.
Yeah. Now I'm non-binary.
You're identified by other people as trans or the opposite sex or something. I don't know.
Right. I'm in limbo. Gender limbo.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
Well, it means that since I transitioned when I was a teenager, I had a sex change, which is a euphemism for having my penis reshaped into the cavity of my body to approximate what the surgeon thought a vagina would be, and had identity changed, name changed, and had been involved in a community of other people who very much affirmed my identity as a woman, and kept running into all of these circumstances of having my actual sex being a factor of my life. And that dichotomy just is not sustainable, or was not for me. And when you're that far down the line of so many decisions over time, you're just dealing with the choices that you've already made at that point. And it's not like hitting the undo button, you know?
I mean, it's interesting that you say hit the undo button. I appreciate your answering my question. I was having a conversation with a woman who reached out to me a couple weeks ago, who's having a problem in her workplace because a while ago, she announced that she's a trans man and her workplace accepted that. And then a couple of years later, she would call herself... She literally calls herself a lesbian detransitioner. I mean, that's how she introduced herself to me. She said, I'm a lesbian detransitioner. She had had the double mastectomy and had not taken a course of testosterone, which I thought was interesting. But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the employer started demanding pronouns in email bios or email signatures, and started mandating that all employees take diversity, equity, and inclusion courses where they were going to talk constantly about gender. And what she told them is that that was traumatic for her because it constantly reminded her of her double mastectomy. And she didn't like the whole pronoun thing was very difficult psychologically for her because she had spent a lot of time and psychological energy and you know, just emotional energy trying to convince everyone in her life that she was a mm-hmm. he, him. And then when she, you know, got comfortable with herself as female and lesbian, she didn't want to talk about pronouns anymore. She just didn't want to talk about pronouns, and she didn't want to talk about gender. She just wanted to heal from what she had gone through. And yeah, they threatened her, you know, with her job and all sorts of horrible things. Anyway, I'm sorry to just go off, but I guess. I have another question, if you don't mind, which would be, do you call yourself a detransitioner? And if not, why not?
No, I call myself I'm basically disillusioned transsexual, right? Transsexual is a description on the basis that I've been a medical patient that has had these treatments for a long time. And I'm ambivalent. That's the word. I'm ambivalent. So like detransition for me would be extremely disruptive. I wouldn't recommend to other people, to the vast majority of people who are transitioning, I wouldn't recommend it. And I am keenly aware that I've taken on voluntarily a lot of potential health problems that'll come up in my life that'll probably shorten my lifespan. And it's just the die is cast. So the most I can do is just try to make whatever choices I can to make the best of it.
There are health issues, right? Like apparently endocrinologists advise if you have your gonads removed, at least at an early age, to have some kind of hormone replacement therapy. So Corinna gets to choose, you know, exogenous estrogen or exogenous testosterone, but is not going to be creating any of this himself. There's not really anything to detransition to. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
And I just don't have the courage, I guess, is probably the most fair term, to take the political stand of throwing over all the relationships in my life that I've built up as an adult to say that I'm detransitioning. That's a huge psychic toll on anybody who detransitions. And if I want to go, if I want to work out, I could have options at home. I don't have to go to a gym. I'm in a tennis club right now, and when I'm playing right now, it's in a mixed sex class. And when I go to play competitively, I'm going to play against men. I'm going to find the path that way. Kind of in the middle somewhere.
There's a lot of conversation among rad femmes about detransitioners. And I found this when they were talking about Scott Nugent. I really admired Scott Nugent's article in Newsweek.
Yeah, it was Newsweek.
Right? Newsweek. Did you see that, Kara?
Yeah, I don't remember it now.
Yeah. Scott was pretty clear about being a mother and being pretty devastated by attempts at changing her sex. At the same time, Scott passes just fine as male. And yeah, so I admired this article, and then some sister radical feminists were just, you know, really angry at Scott for not detransitioning. And I just thought, man, she's been through so much. Like she has infections like every week, it seems, you know, her body is falling apart. And when someone's been through that much medical trauma, I just think, just stop. Like you don't have to transition or detransition, just stop where you are and just stop. Like there's nothing you really need to do but stop. That's my take on it personally.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, if you're asking me, I don't think that I want to have a take on that, because I don't really feel like it's my business, you know, but this whole thing that we're talking about now with the woman who called me and called herself a detransition lesbian and you, Corinna, it's like all of this, it's like at the end of the day, we're all female or male, right? And it's that is very important. I mean, I don't want to be preachy, but like it is very important for feminists to fight for the rights, privacy, and safety of women and girls, of which Scott is one, right? So I'm guessing, I didn't see the dust up that you're talking about, Nina, but I can imagine I can imagine it. I'm assuming that a lot of those women who were arguing with you were arguing that Scott's female. And so like, let's be team female here and stop denying the reality.
Yeah. And I don't think Scott is denying the reality.
I don't think so either.
I don't think I'm denying the reality. I'm, you know, although I have to admit, I have to conscientiously use female pronouns for Scott, because Scott really passes. It is a bit of a mind fuck. But you know, I've made my decision to use sex-based pronouns. So I refer to Scott as she, and I refer to Corinna as he, but I'm not going to lie. People who pass, that's the thing. They're rare, but it's a thing. Passing is a thing.
Isn't it true? And please tell me if it's not. Isn't it true that it's easier for a female person to pass as male than vice versa, because it's easier to put on muscle mass and gain facial hair than the reverse.
Yeah, I think that's commonly the case. But I think that also assumes that, I've seen some trans men who are very curvy and whose profile are without a doubt feminine profiles. So I think that it's probably easier for women to pass as men on testosterone, but I don't think it's universal.
Yeah, I mean, especially as the trans culture has changed from passing and assimilating to just declaring pronouns and trying to bend people to your will. I think
that's for sure. I guess I meant.
Oh, we forgot to ask for your pronouns, Carla.
Come on. Knock it off. Those are my pronouns.
I've always wondered.
I know. I'm sure. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, maybe just because of where we were just talking, I don't know if it would. Look, it's your show, so you decide how you want to end the show. I was just going to offer a little story, if it would be helpful.
Oh, please.
Story. Right.
Okay, so until late 2019, I worked for a job downtown, and I would take the Metro home, and there's this really lovely bar next to the Metro right on my way home, and they had a great deal on Cosmos. They had $5 Cosmopolitans. And so I would frequently go there, have one Cosmopolitan and go home. So this one day I'm going there. And part of the reason I loved the bar so much is the ambiance was so great. They played fantastic music and it was an all-female staff. And I was just in heaven when I went there. It was just great. So I'm walking up to the bar and it's unusually full. Usually there are just a couple people there, but this time it was unusually full. And there happened to be two seats at the bar next to each other. And on the one on my right, as I was approaching, the person next to the empty seat was very clearly a guy. And the person next to the other seat on my left was someone who appeared to be a very tall, thin woman with blonde hair up in a bun and wearing a women's business suit. And ordinarily, if I'm going to a bar alone, I very consciously, if I have the choice between sitting next to a man versus sitting next to a woman, I'll sit next to a woman. It's just whatever. Like, that's just the choice I make. And for whatever reason, I had the choice of these two seats, one next to who was someone who was clearly obviously a guy, and one next to someone who appeared to be a woman. But I just kind of felt myself gravitating toward the seat that was next to the guy. And it was a little weird that I did that, but whatever. I wasn't paying too much attention. I was listening to music, whatever. So I sit down and I'm right next to this guy and there's an empty seat next to me. And then this person who appeared to be a woman, and I'm sitting there and I have my Cosmopolitan and I'm playing on my phone. The guy to my right, he proceeds to just ignore me. He doesn't bother me. He doesn't flirt with me. He doesn't hit on me, nothing. It's all fine. And the empty seat's here. And then there's this person. And all of a sudden, I like looked up from my Facebook or whatever, and I thought, wait, is that a guy? Because I read that person as a woman. And I don't know what it was, but something suggested that it was a guy. And I was so confused. And this is just a couple years ago. I had been immersed in gender stuff for years. It didn't even dawn on me. Oh, this is a, you know, a guy pretending to be a woman, or, you know. It didn't even dawn on me. I just kept questioning myself, like, is this a man? And then I would look and the person had their back to me. And so, you know, blonde hair in a bun, business suit, looked to be a woman. And so then I was thinking I was going crazy because it very clearly seemed to be a woman. Went back to my phone, da 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 da. And I kept thinking there was something about the voice or the mannerisms, or I don't even know what. I kept questioning myself. And I kind of, you know, I didn't want to be rude, but I kind of kept looking over. And then I heard the person say something like, I was 70 when I transitioned and 72 when I came out, or, you know, something along
those lines. Wow.
And then somebody walked behind me to introduce himself. That was clearly a guy to the person. And then I saw, and then the person turned he turned, and that I just could clearly tell, like, that that was definitely a man. And for the half hour that I was sitting there, it was weird because I could tell there was something about that guy that was a guy, but the outward appearance from the back didn't let me know that. And it felt, I realized it felt like, it felt really dangerous to me. What he was doing felt very dangerous to me because I was fooled and I was questioning myself and I was in a bar. And for a woman to be alone in a bar and questioning herself about what's going on with the sex of the people around her is scary. Anyway, that's my story.
Well, it reminds me of what my dad used to tell me, which is that it's better to be quiet and let people assume that you're a woman than to open your mouth and remove all doubt.
It's.
I think I'll let the silence speak for the how well the joke landed.
Well, can you repeat it?
It's better to be quiet and let people think you're a woman than to open your mouth and remove all doubt.
Got it.
Because Lincoln said, it's better. No, never mind.
I got it.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting story because that really calls fundamentally into question the whole trans enterprise. And to, like, to say that normalizing the mimicry of the opposite sex could actually be dangerous for women.
Yeah.
And that really pushes against, well, it pushes against a lot of, I guess, what I would call liberal ideas. It's very challenging, right? Because in a way, I mean, like, what I've been saying as I've been canceled and lied about and stuff like that is like, no, I'm not transphobic. I am not transphobic. Why are they saying I'm transphobic? I am not transphobic. And I'm not, right? Like, I, you know, I've slept with trans-identified men, not Corinna. I need to make that more clear on this UK podcast.
It's too late.
I've slept with heterosexual trans-identified men, and I thought trans was like super cool, and I thought gender bending was super cool and transgressive and all that sort of stuff. So no, I really am genuinely not transphobic. And there is an argument to be made that, you know, it's not all fun and games. Gender bending is not, or it's not gender bending, but, you know, like, actually attempting to pass as the opposite sex or cross-dressing is not all fun and games. And the thing is, for me, it was. For me, it was all fun and games. And I want people to have fun and play games. And I don't like that there's this element to it. Likewise, you know, another ongoing argument among radical feminists is drag, right? Yeah. Like, it's woman face and it's inherently misogynistic. I loved drag when I lived in San Francisco. I actually found the existence of drag really liberating because of my own, I guess you'd call it, gender dysphoria. I refused to wear anything that a boy wouldn't wear starting at the age of 8. And I relented a little bit when I was 17 or 18 and was actually able to start having relationships with guys and they liked dresses. But my daily attire was, you know, as gender neutral as I could make it. It was just t-shirts and corduroys and sneakers. But then I lived in the Castro and there were all these men wearing flamboyant, fascinating clothing. And I went like, oh, okay. Yeah. I'm not going to wear anything a boy won't wear. Boys wear this. I'll wear this. And for me, it was liberating and fun. But I also the argument that it is women faced or that it is misogynistic, that is not without merit. I'm not going to say that's untrue. I still like drag, but I respect the critiques of it.
Yeah. I mean, I get where you're coming from. And I do want to push back against it, not you, but I want to push back against the idea in general that drag is inconsistent with feminism. Like, I definitely am on side anti-drag, mm-hmm. even though I understand your own personal experience of feeling liberated by it. Just one more story I will tell you. I have a close friend who 5 years ago on Facebook, I said something that was what we would call gender critical. And she posted a comment that said, "I stand with my trans friends." And she hasn't ditched me as a friend after all these years. 5 years ago, she was a massive, what we would probably call TRA, right? Like, mm-hmm. we all know what we're talking. Okay. Massive. Okay. So, and I haven't known her that long. I haven't known her much longer than she and I have been engaged in this discussion. And I've really listened to her and I've brought her around, like, on so many things. I have brought her around on, like, women's sports is a no-brainer for her. Self-ID is a no-brainer for her. But I know her life history enough to know that she spent the night, she's in her early 60s. She spent the 1970s in the punk scene, and she spent the 1980s socially in the drag scene, and more specifically, administering healthcare to HIV and AIDS patients. And she is deeply, deeply, deeply emotionally attached to the idea that there is something innate about gender because of her. Now, I don't want to say who this is. I don't want her to watch this. Me as a friend yet. And that tells me that she knows that I'm onto something, but I also do understand her deep and emotional commitment to social movements of the 1980s and her sort of, what I'm hearing you say too, was like a really personal feeling of liberation that came from hanging out in drag communities. I get that.
To clarify though, what I like about drag still, not always, but sometimes, is that I see it as viciously mocking gender, not viciously mocking women, but viciously mocking gender. And I also, you know, gender is worthy of mockery.
Yeah.
So I like it for that reason.
So, like, we could have that conversation about whether drag is ultimately good or bad for that. But I guess I wanted to share that story that I have this friend who is struggling mightily. Like, she wants to get to a place where she knows there's something wrong going on. She knows it, but she has what is, I would say, a very sincere and a very deeply held emotional commitment to gender. It's hard for her to get out of, for reasons that felt similar to what you were describing.
I don't know. We could have her on. She and I could talk and see how similar we are. But yeah, I mean, I would love to take all the teeth out of gender. But you know what? People are so diverse and weird, and they're going to do things I don't like, and they're going to use drugs I don't like, and they're going to have belief systems I don't like, and they're just going to be, like, vastly different from me. So really my thing is, like, just, you know, let's keep the reality of sex and what you do for, like, you know, like, just don't have men in women's prisons. Don't have men in women's locker rooms. And outside of that, it's like, do whatever. I don't have to like it.
Yeah. We'd probably disagree on a little bit of that stuff, but that's all right.
Yeah.
That's pluralism, right?
I mean, it's just that, like, humans do so much stuff that I hate, right? Like, you know, why just focus on this? There's tons of them. There's tons of religions that I I just hate. And I do really, I wish that this were just classified as a religion. I feel like so many problems would be solved if it was just like, yep, we're going to call this genderism. It's a religion. You are free to practice this religion. You are not free to impose it on anyone else. You are not free to, you know, force children to learn it in schools. It's a religion. You know, enjoy separation of church and state.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are legal challenges with that too, because then if it's a religion and we have separation of church and state, then it gets protected. And I'm not sure I want to go down that path. But I'm going to have to go because I just have to go.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you
for being so generous with your time. The book is Abolishing Sex.
The Abolition of Sex. The
Abolition of Sex. Mm-hmm. And right. We'll have a link to it to Amazon. And as soon as Amazon bans it, Cara, would you please let us know where else to find it?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Cara.
Have a great
day. Bye.
Good night.
Bye.